لم تطيه قوس قزح طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من
مخيم. Welcome to the December 28th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm, and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. We start today's show with an important short interview, courtesy of the Electronic Intifada, on the significance of the recent American Studies Association BDS victory. EI correspondent Nora Barrows Friedman interviews professor and activist Stephen Salaita, about what this victory means for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We follow this interview with part one of a discussion courtesy of Palestine Studies TV that pits Hussein Ibish, senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and columnist for The Nation, against Nur Eric Hatt, human rights attorney and co-founder of Jadalilia, debating the question, can the U.S. broker a two-state solution? Part two of this interesting discussion will be broadcast 2 weeks from today. Stay tuned for a thought-provoking segment of This Week in Palestine, and thank you for your support throughout the year in bringing the Palestinian perspective to a broader audience. And now here's the interview with the Electronic Intifada. And this is of the Nora Barrows speaking with Stephen Salaita.
To a milestone victory in the international movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. On December 4th, the American Studies Association's National Council unanimously approved a resolution to boycott Israeli academic institutions and subsequently held a referendum for its membership to endorse or reject the resolution. As our next guest, Stephen Salaita, wrote earlier this week, the move to seek the approval of membership was unusual, a tacit concession to the shrinking contingent of Zionists in the American Studies Association, but the surest way to determine where membership stands on a contentious issue. The membership made its stance remarkably clear. In a landslide victory on Monday, December 16th, just over 66% of voters endorsed the resolution, with about 30% disapproving and about 3% abstaining. In all, 1,252 members participated in the largest ASA vote in history. Salaita adds, quote, "Majoritarianism in itself is never a guarantee of ethical propriety. In this case, however, the majority got it right. The resolution is momentous and provides discernible energy to those committed to justice for Palestinians and to creating educational systems that refuse to operate as servants to state power." Stephen Salaita joined us to talk about the significance of the American Studies Association's endorsement of the academic boycott of Israel. He's a professor at Virginia Tech and will be at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign next fall, and is the author of, most recently, Israel's Dead Soul. I asked him to talk about the boycott resolution and how big of a victory it is for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement, and why.
I think it's quite important, on many levels, but mainly because the victory for the ASA resolution was very much in the public eye. And I think a lot of people were looking towards that association and its process to kind of gauge what the mood around boycott and BDS more generally is. And I think a lot of folks, on both the Zionist left and right are displeased with how the result came out because it speaks in some way to the type of momentum that boycott is receiving as a form of nonviolent resistance, and a form of nonviolent resistance also that is very difficult for them to contest with the usual remonstrations that they have. So I think it was important politically, but I think very important symbolically as well.
Stephen, you recently wrote a post about what the resolution does and does not mean, partly because there has been a rash of Zionist attempts to discredit and malign the academic boycott, including statements that it's somehow a boycott of Jewish people. Can you lay out what this resolution does and doesn't mean?
Sure. It means, first of all, that the ASA as an academic organization would sever all of its ties with Israeli academe or Israeli academic institutions or governmental institutions. Let me be clear, the ASA has never had, nor does it currently have, any of those associations to sever, you know, any of those relationships to sever. But the resolution would prevent it from entering into those sorts of arrangements in the future. It doesn't have any binding power over its individual members, so the individual members who disagreed with the resolution can certainly continue to, you know, to have relationships with Israeli academe and receive Israeli funding, whatever they want to do. But the resolution does discourage its members from doing those sorts of things. It also means that the ASA would not host any speakers who are emissaries of the Israeli government. And an emissary of the Israeli government would be somebody either directly representing that government or somebody who is receiving state funding in order to go on a speaking tour or a cultural program or whatever the case may be. The boycott doesn't affect any Israeli individuals. Only those who act in the context of an emissary of the Israeli government. So it would never prevent a citizen of Israel, Palestinian, Jewish, Druze, otherwise, from submitting research to peer-reviewed journals, from acting as a peer reviewer, from traveling anywhere that he or she pleased, these sorts of things. So it's largely an institutional thing, and it's a way for the ASA to sort of make policy of the fact that until Israeli academic institutions cease their complicity with Israel's occupation, that the ASA doesn't want to do business with them.
Stephen, can you give us more of a sense of how Israeli academic institutions are working in collusion with the Israeli government and what that means for policies on the ground and especially for Palestinians?
Right. Just like in the United States, Israeli academe is a part and parcel of government programs. We know that a lot of research for the atomic bomb in the U.S., for example, happened at Harvard. And, you know, a lot of the you know, Centers for Diplomacy and Global Studies are really in cahoots with making or with the state in terms of making or influencing policy. And the same thing is true in Israel. I think it might be even more brazen in Israel in the sense that a lot of studies have illustrated clearly how both faculty and universities themselves, as represented by their administrations, help develop a lot of the gerrymandering policies Israel uses to ascertain Jewish majorities, both inside Israel, then of course in certain spaces in the West Bank, East Jerusalem particularly. It helps the IDF develop military systems and tactical and logistical systems as well. It helps the universities also help inform particular discriminatory policies that get carried out by the state, policies on land ownership, education, etc. In fact, in terms of archaeology also, right, a lot of Israeli academics and their institutions are complicit in inventing a sort of archaeology that invents a Jewish past at the expense of a Palestinian one as a way of kind of backdating a rationale for colonization. So any of the major policies of Israel that you can think of that are objectionable, and there are lots of them, there's almost certainly been found to be a connection to Israeli academe.
Well, finally, what do you credit to the extraordinary success of this boycott resolution, and what can people learn from this endorsement of the Palestinian-led BDS movement?
We can learn that it's possible to put pressure, even in small ways, on the sites of power in Israel and the United States that contribute to the colonization of Palestinians, that it's possible to raise awareness of what's actually happening in Palestine. It's possible also, and I think this is a really, really important thing, to kind of shift the rules for engaging this issue in academe, especially where discussion of Palestinians has been verboten and has been really for a lot of people a career killer. It's been a thing that folks have been scared to do. And one of our goals is not simply to put pressure on the Israeli state, but also to open spaces of discourse in the United States where people can discuss these issues without retribution, and where they can discuss these issues without facing the sorts of institutional punishments that so many of us have gone through and continue to go through. It means also, I guess more than anything, it means that we can only have as much momentum as sort of the American polity is willing to provide us. And the fact that the American polity is providing us enough momentum to where we have made boycott of Israel a mainstream issue means that the Zionists have every right from their point of view to be upset and angry. It's because they are ceding ground at a remarkable rate. And as long as we sort of continue pushing for this form of justice as dictated by, you know, by the Palestinians themselves, of course, but also by universal standards of basic ethical behavior, you know, then we can continue to push that momentum forward and get more people thinking about where their tax dollars are going.
That is the voice of Stephen Saleta. He's a professor and the author of Israel's Dead Soul. You're also a blogger for the Electronic Intifada, and we'll have links up to your most recent posts about the American Studies Association's boycott move on the podcast blog. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm Omar Badar. For 20 years, Israelis and Palestinians have been engaged in a U.S.-led peace process that aims to achieve a two-state solution. But that process has failed time and again because there has been a pattern that has existed regardless of the status of negotiations. Israel kept expanding settlements in vital parts of the Palestinian territories, making the creation of a viable Palestinian state less and less likely. So here we are, 20 years later, with another round of negotiations, and even though they're supposed to be secret, it has been leaked to the press that the negotiations are leading to no progress. So the question, of course, is there a point to these negotiations? And if there is the U.S. the right party to be leading them? And beyond that, beyond the diplomatic process, can Palestinians achieve better progress for themselves pursuing other means, perhaps the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, as an example? And more broadly, given all the obstacles that stand in the way of the creation of a viable Palestinian state, is switching over to one-state advocacy a viable alternative? To debate these questions, we are joined by Hussein Ibish. He is a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine and a weekly columnist at The National. We're also joined by Noor Arakat. She is a human rights lawyer, the co-editor of the electronic magazine Jadalia, and the Abraham L. Friedman Fellow at Temple Law School. Thank you both for being with us.
Sure. Thank
you, guys. So, Hussein, just to kick things off with you, let's start with just the first question. Do you think there is a point to these negotiations that are ongoing right now?
Well, I certainly wouldn't expect them to yield major progress on any of the final status issues in the immediate term. I think we have to be very clear about the distance between the parties and the political circumstances facing both Israel, the Israeli leadership and the Palestinian leadership, that makes that unlikely. I think that might lead some people to conclude, then there's no point. But I think that's wrong, because, first of all, they can certainly yield incremental changes that are useful, that don't necessarily get us closer to a final status agreement, but that get us closer to political conditions where we can actually have negotiations that get there. I mean, the situation is unlikely to deteriorate because of negotiations, unless they collapse completely. Finally, I'd like to say, negotiations are always important, especially, I think, from a Palestinian point of view, because ultimately, what else do you have? other than negotiations. Even if you combine them, even if you employ other tactics, nonviolent protests, certain kinds of boycotts or others, all diplomatic moves in international form, in the end, you're going to come back to the negotiating table. So since negotiations are all you have, I think ultimately, no matter what, I think negotiating is always helpful. The rejoinder would be, well, some other negotiations, not these negotiations, but this is what's available now, and I think not engaging in them is sort of completely pointless in my view.
Well, I think that these negotiations are not just pointless, but they are quite detrimental. We've seen from the record of negotiations under the terms of Oslo for the past 20 years create the conditions today that have made establishing a state, an independent Palestinian state, even more unlikely. Worse than that, it's actually created a gulf and a rift between the Palestinian population itself, not just those between the West Bank and Gaza, but even those within the West Bank itself have become increasingly divided from one another as a result of the conditions that have evolved over the past 20 years, including but not limited to the route of the annexation wall, including the establishment of multiple firing zones that are basically military zones used for Israeli army to practice shooting. And they conveniently happen to be on top of Palestinian lands. Beyond just the issue of actually lands, however, these negotiations under the terms of Oslo have created a diplomatic veneer for Israel to continue a military strategy of conquest and of settler expansionism, and have actually afforded themselves greater impunity under our human rights legal regime for doing so. So I do think that not only are these negotiations pointless, but they're dangerous. What I'm not saying that we shouldn't have negotiations. We should have negotiations, but they should be on different terms. They should be those terms that actually challenge the status, the balance of power between the parties, which is incredibly inequitable, and quite an irony, given that this is a very political situation. We have a stateless population under occupation and in exile against a militarized state, the largest nuclear power in the Middle East, the fourth largest military in the world, backed by global superpower, and yet we have removed politics and the question of power altogether.
I think there's a factual, we have a kind of a one factual, core factual disagreement in between what I said and what you said, which is that you think that the negotiation structure makes settlement activity easier for the Israelis. And I actually think that's not true. The settlements go forward no matter what. When the Palestinians are engaged in negotiations, it's more difficult for the Israelis actually to build settlements. When the Palestinians withdraw from negotiations, the Israelis feel, I think, they have more of a free hand. The truth is, the settlement project has gone forward anyway, with or without negotiations, but generally speaking, except for that period between 93 and 98, where they actually doubled the number of settlers under this framework, after that, it's been harder for Israel to expand settlements when Palestinians were actually in negotiations, especially vis-a-vis the United States, which has actually held the Israelis back from some key areas. E1, for example, expanding some of the other sort of even more strategic areas. So I think that, you know, it may seem de minimis that it slows the settlement project, but it's actually a helpful thing.
I disagree with that. I think that...
I mean, factually?
Factually.
Okay.
Factually, I disagree with that. And so that's why I want to intervene. Israel has most recently, right after the declaration of this resumption of peace talks, declared its intention to expand its 1,200 new settlement units. Yeah. And so we are seeing that Israel is using these opportunities to blatantly say to an international community, we are in negotiations, we should not be held to account, and they're flexing that muscle by announcing their settlement expansion. More than that, it is actually part of a structural diplomatic veneer, and I do think that Oslo affords it cover because of the terms of Oslo, which do not reference international law on this question. Oslo doesn't reference international law on this issue, and so according under the terms of Oslo, Israel's settlement expansion around Jerusalem, for example, has been legal.
Under the terms of Oslo,
54% of the pre-existing settlements were not considered settlements, but were considered Jerusalem housing units. And so nothing that the negotiations do actually counters that. Let me just finish the thought. Let me just finish the thought about this idea that it's not the terms of Oslo. John, Secretary Kerry, right now, is using negotiations as a tool to wield pressure against the European Union, which has put pressure on Israel to end its settlement expansion by actually enacting some sort of economic boycott with those industries in the occupied territory, right? And Secretary Kerry is basically telling the EU and applying pressure on it that in order to move forward with negotiations, you need to remove these conditions. This is a structural issue. Israel is allowed to expand its settlements with impunity, without pressure, in exchange for entering into negotiations.
Actually, I don't think that's right. I think if you look at the international reaction to settlement activity, Israel is not allowed to do this. It hasn't become legal. Israel is not prevented physically from doing it. Mm-hmm. But everyone objects, including the United States. And sometimes American objections are effective, and sometimes they're not. It depends how firmly the United States draws the line. E1 project has been on the table and approved for 25 years, and it hasn't been created, largely because the United States has said, this is a step too far. Now, I do think it's true that Israel makes a lot of announcements about settlement expansions, and sometimes they actually do build them, and sometimes they don't. I think it's harder to do it under when negotiations are going on than when they're not. I just think that's generally a factual matter. But
can you also address the thing about framework?
Well, I agree, and I've always said from the day it was signed that the biggest flaw here is that it doesn't prevent Israel from building more settlements. And I mean, I think that's the single biggest of several flaws in the Oslo framework. Correcting it was tried by President Obama. He was not able to do that for various reasons. He wasn't able to do that, and so the question is, how best do you restrain the Israelis from a practical point of view at this point? And I think the only force that can restrain them, that does restrain them at all, is not anything in their domestic politics, nor anything in the broader international framework. But the United States, when it does put its foot down, has actually been effective. It's the only thing I can see that has been effective.
So this is actually an excellent segue to the next thing we want to talk about. You mentioned that the Obama administration has not been able to completely stop Israeli settlement expansion. So given those kinds of constraints that exist within the United States, we can start with you on this question and go the other way. Do you think the United States is in a position to be mediating this process moving forward, and is it the best player to do that?
Absolutely not. I think that the U.S. has been a fundamental part of the problem. The U.S. is not only unwilling to exert any pressure upon Israel in order to stop its settlement expansion, but even when it is willing, it's demonstrated itself to be unable to do so. And that unwillingness is demonstrated time and again as a result of domestic political considerations, which are understandable, but it also demonstrates that the U.S.'s own hands are tied. When President Obama entered into office, he made this one of his primary goals in order to stop settlement expansion, and was immediately stopped in his tracks. Vice President Joseph Biden was rebuffed on a diplomatic visit to the region. Upon his return, President Obama was lambasted by his parties on both sides of the aisle, who basically said, you can't do that to our closest friend, and chastised the president and gave Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu more standing ovations than they did to the president in a State of the Union address. That immediately chilled the U.S.'s willingness to move forward on this. Okay, so we've seen that when they want to, diplomatic considerations make them quite ineffective, despite the fact that the George H.W. Bush administration showed that they have many tools in their arsenal in order to apply pressure, such as cutting certain forms of aid, which is, by the way, in accordance with U.S. law. The unwillingness is further demonstrated by the U.S.'s own hampering of other processes, like the February 2011 U.N. Security Council resolution on settlements, which mirrored U.S. language. Yeah. And yet the U.S. was the sole veto on that as well. And so we've seen that the U.S. has been unwilling in most instances, and when it is, as we saw early in the Obama administration, it's been unable to do anything?
Well, it's not true that it's unable to do anything, because it has successfully restrained some Israeli settlement activity in the past. We've agreed that there are some areas which you can see would have been built on but for the United States. And I think your reference to the first George Bush administration and its pressure on Israel, which was successful, dealing with still the most right-wing prime minister in the history of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir. So it can be done. I do think it's fair to say that the issue was not handled deftly in the first Obama term, and I think they know that. The UN Security Council resolution is actually really crucial here. And I think it was maybe a politically beneficial to the leadership in Ramallah, to President Abbas in particular, to take a stand on the United States over the word illegal. The United States would have abstained, apparently, according to all reports, on that resolution if they had described the settlements as illegitimate. Even though it is U.S. policy that they're illegal, they didn't care to use the word illegal. Mm-hmm. The Palestinians insisted, based on international law, which is true, and based on the fact that it is U.S. policy, on the word illegal, and so the U.S. did veto it. And I think the Obama administration felt extremely uncomfortable. And I think they felt burned by both sides, actually, which is why they kind of dropped the issue entirely. Not settlements, but the Israel-Palestine issue for the last year, year and a half of the first Obama term, picked up again by Secretary Kerry. So whatever political benefit in Ramallah and in among Palestinians President Abbas got for that stance and that veto, actually, I think, very much undermined the idea that settlements are unlawful. And if you can blame the United States for that veto, and that absolutely, okay, but it was a Palestinian decision to force that hand. They knew the veto was coming, and it was over a word. They could have accepted the word illegitimate, and they didn't for reasons that are completely understandable, but with consequences where, after that, Israel really felt that in an international legal framework, they'd just been given a carte blanche. So you have to go back and ask yourself whether that was a wise move or not, and I think the answer is no on both counts. I think the U.S. should have vetoed that resolution, but I knew they were going to. So if I had been in charge of Palestinian diplomacy, I wouldn't have put myself in a situation where the Security Council doesn't.
But the question, just if I can focus on that particular point, right, given the fact that the U.S. is too constrained to allow a resolution like that to go through, what do you think about the idea that maybe they're not the best ones to?
Well, for sure there are a lot of drawbacks with any mediator, and particularly the United States. The United States is exceedingly close to Israel in the way that Noura described, and perfectly accurately. I mean, I don't disagree with what you said at all. Which means that the United States is in some ways a problematic mediator, but there are several things to keep in mind. And first of all, the United States is the only available mediator, frankly, because there's no other international body, group, country, power that actually wants to take this up. Secondly, ultimately, the Palestinians need Israel to agree to something. And I think there is an upside to what is otherwise a bleak picture about the U.S.-Israel relationship, which is that ultimately the United States could theoretically deliver Israel, and no other party can do that. So if you're talking about getting an agreement, ultimately the United States is a useful party. In a counterfactual world, it might be great to have a multilateral process, a UN process, EU, China, what have you. That's great. That sounds really interesting. That's a counterfactual world. That's a world that doesn't exist. In the real world, you can have one of two things. You can have either a flawed but sort of, in certain ways, functional U.S. brokered set of talks, in which does carry some benefits for the Palestinians, in my opinion, as well as some problems, but mainly it certainly does help more than it hurts, I think, without doubt, in my view. Or you can have bilateral talks just between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which we've seen. But I still think it's true that given the great asymmetry of power that Noura referred to, which we all agree, is the essence of not only the conflict, but the essence of the problem of resolving the conflict, is that you have a massive power versus a powerless, stateless, unarmed people. This is an absurd equation. In my view, there does have to be a balancing set of powers. And right now, for all of its flaws, the United States is the only available actor. And in that sense, I would call it indispensable. I don't think you can do without it. Much as you might find domestic American politics very, very frustrating, I just don't see where the alternative is.
Is there an alternative to the U.S., and can anybody else deliver Israel to a peace agreement besides the United States?
So these are really excellent questions. Just a few points on what you said. One, we, in the discussion of the UN Security Council resolution, this idea over wording may or may not be accurate, only because at the time the White House spokesperson Scott McLennan had said this is not a matter to be resolved in a multilateral institution. It needs to be kept within a bilateral process. And so there was inherent objection to any type of international law being brought into this or other parties, and the U.S. was insistent on that because under these conditions it can control it using politics alone, and politics, as we know, is a matter of power and negotiating power. And negotiating power. But however it is, the message in the aftermath of it was that this is not a matter to be resolved in international and multilateral institutions. So that's one.
We agree.
Absolutely, yeah. Which also dampens the already very poor record that the U.S. has established for itself over two decades. On the second issue of whether or not the U.S., this idea of the U.S. being able to deliver, even when the U.S. is not the sole mediator, which is really the issue, it's not that this can be resolved without the U.S., very few issues can be resolved without the U.S. Somehow it is global superpower, right. So let's not be naive.
Right.
But the question is, how do we then confront that power when it's actually detrimental to achieving the goals that we all share, right? And so in this instance, even when the U.S. wasn't alone and wasn't given the responsibility to mediate, when it was in the quartet, for example, it also worked to, I want to say, demolish, to ruin, to basically make any quartet achievements impossible because of its insistence on certain political outcomes. So there we've seen, again, that even when the U.S. doesn't have the sole responsibility, it also has a detrimental role.
You know,
I just wanted to finish.
I thought I still have to agree with you, so I wanted to explain why, but I'll come back.
But just to continue on the role of the U.S. as the sole mediator, I think that the problem that we have is that we're working in absolutes. Either it's the negotiations with the U.S., or it's some sort of grassroots, you know, power to the people type of approach. And I'm actually of the opinion that there is no single tactic necessary to move forward, but that they all have to work in concert. And whatever is going to be done in order to move forward, and if negotiations are a necessary part of this equation, a lot of thought and effort have to be put into how do we then challenge the U.S.'s role in these negotiations. And finally, we shouldn't overestimate the U.S.'s role. When the Palestinians wanted to, they were able to garner a U.N. General Assembly resolution for Palestinian statehood overwhelmingly in November 2012. When it wanted to, it was able to become a member of UNESCO despite U.S. opposition. And we've seen now EU support for the Palestinians, and there is clear, palpable signs that there's alternatives to this dead-end route.
It's true that the Palestinians have a built-in majority in any multilateral forum, which is one country, one vote. I mean, it's automatic. And they could do things that are really confrontational to the United States, like joining the IAEA or the World Intellectual Property Organization. You want to break the Ramallah-Washington relationship for 10 years, that's what you would do. So you have to calibrate using that majority in a very clever diplomatic way. It's part of the mix. It's definitely a form of leverage available to Palestinians that should be used in an intelligent way, without any doubt. I want to come back though to the quartet. Remember, the quartet is very important because you're absolutely right. The quartet, which is the Secretariat, the EU, Russia, and the United States, so basically the powers of the world, okay? And the quartet really was established, I mean, taking all the theoretical stuff aside, it was established to give a broader international imprimatur to what the U.S. was doing in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. And everything was fine until the settlement issue broke down. You're absolutely right about that. And then the quartet was unable for the first time to issue a joint statement because of disputes over the settlement issue and the American switch on the settlement issue, saying it tried to get a freeze and it only got a fraudulent one, which only lasted 10 months, in which there was no slowdown in settlement construction, and couldn't even extend it for 3 months. So what's... No, you know, you point out, and I think you make a good point there, that what that shows is that the a kind of flaw in the U.S. role. Fine. What it also shows, though, is that these other actors simply, what they can do is withdraw their consent from what the Americans are doing, and that's it. So that's the point. As far as the quartet went, which represented everybody else, essentially, plus the U.S., when they broke down, the U.S. simply continued on its own, and the quartet just couldn't do anything. So it's not like Russia, the EU, the Secretariat, or anybody else was ready to take up the role. They weren't. They were... The only thing that they could do was just withdraw their consent. And that shows, I think, the limitations of the factual world we live in which it's not just that other states and institutions don't have the power to do this. They're not willing to do it. They're not sort of interested in doing it. You can get whatever you want to through the General Assembly. That's true. But the General Assembly has very limited powers. And I think that the main power that they have has already been exercised, which is the upgrade of Palestine to a state, a non-member state. And that's it's important that Palestine is a state. And it's important that Palestine become a member state of the United Nations. But ultimately, without... the Security Council, you can't do that.
I just want to respond. Just to be completely clear, this isn't about with or without the U.S. This is about how to be strategic and actually balancing the U.S.'s detrimental role. And in fact, what we've seen time and again from other states is that they also need that nod from the Palestinian leadership of how to move forward. Other states can't do more than what the Palestinian leadership asks them to do. We don't want them to do more because that would be detrimental to Palestinians being able to decide their own fate.
Right.
But this Palestinian leadership, because of being under the tutelage of American diplomatic and economic support, has refrained from going outside of those boundaries that the U.S. has set. And that's also why. It's not just an unwillingness.
Right.
That's also why we haven't seen any alternatives.
I think you're right. There's a cost. There's a heavy cost to be paid.
Because we're short on time, let's go ahead and tackle, I think, probably the biggest question that's on the table at this point, which is the question of whether, given all the obstacles that we're facing right now in the Palestinian territories, the number of settlers is nearly 750,000. A lot of people are just saying that a viable Palestinian state is so unlikely to come about. Why not switch over to advocating for a single, secular state, one man, one vote for all Israelis and Palestinians? What do you see as a
very, very, very simply, it's not available. The Israelis will not agree to it. You can't convince them, in my view, to agree to it. There's no quid pro quo as there was in South Africa, where it was a win-win for both sides. That doesn't exist here. I just don't think it's an achievable goal, unless you were to project many decades into the future, again, and have a counterfactual reality. In the present existing reality, it's not an achievable goal. So embracing a non-achievable goal is, to me, truly a pointless exercise.
I think that it's really mind-boggling to call this not an achievable goal, even though it hasn't been tried, next to the two-state solution, which has been tried for decades, which has proven less achievable. And so it's just mind-boggling to use that as the reason that the one-state solution isn't a better tactic or a better vision and a goal to pursue. The Dini Reiter, an Israeli journalist recently in Al Jazeera America, quoted an Israeli poll where 55.9% of Israelis support resuming the negotiations. In that same poll, 55.5% of the same Israelis polled don't believe that the settlements should be removed. Mm-hmm. And so we see this fundamental contradiction and this assumption that Israelis can be convinced of anything. Why would a people who live in relative wealth, mm-hmm. stability, relative wealth, stability with palpable privilege, forego any of that,
right.
for any alternative unless they were pressured to do so morally, legally, politically. And that leverage has not been exerted on this population. So I don't think that we should really think about that's not achievable. This idea of a one-state solution has not been pursued for decades for it to merit this kind of absolute...
Well, you have to ask, I have to say, political thinking always begins with the fundamental premise, what is achievable given the array of forces that produce outcomes? Those are political forces, social forces, economic forces, and military forces. You've got to be able to do the math and come up with the equation, okay? If something if the math cannot be done to produce an equation, then I say this is not political thinking at all. This is some other kind of thinking. Now, Noura, it's very interesting because she says it's mind-boggling to dismiss a one-state solution, even when I think it's...
On the premises that you just...
On the grounds that it's not achievable, right. Now, my response is what's mind-boggling is to say that an end to the occupation, which is a limited goal, supported by international law, even Israeli policy says officially that it seeks a two-state solution. Okay. You can dismiss that all you like. This huge body of international law, international consensus, majority opinion on both sides wanting this thing, okay, and just to look at that and say, because over 20 years we haven't been able to achieve it, and we're all equally frustrated with that, I think, that therefore the corrective is to tackle a task that is infinitely, exponentially more difficult to achieve, which is not to end the occupation, but to fundamentally change or transform or replace the Israeli state with a different kind of state. And there we leave the realm, utterly, of international consensus, international law, what is politically feasible, even conceptually, and we enter into a realm of counterfactual fantasy, in my view. And I don't think it's useful, politically, for a people, a movement, a cause, to proceed on the basis of a bunch of counterfactuals. I think you need to base your analysis in reality.
I have several responses to that. The first is, I don't know about my math. You'd have to ask my math teacher. The last time I took it was in high school. And I got to calculus.
That's not bad, actually.
Well, my teachers could have told you that, but that's not the point. But looking at this, I think that my math actually adds up, because we're looking at all of this political support, international law on our side, a consensus that we have internationally, and failure, not just failure to end the occupation, but an entrenchment in the occupation. And so if my math is correct, unless we have some sort of non-numbers and negatives is correct, politically and mathematically, this is proven to be a failure under these terms. Even the most ardent supporter of the two-state solution has to be an equally strident opponent to the terms of Oslo and the U.S. as a sole broker in these conditions. So let me get back to the idea of a one-state, though, here. So one of the basic assumptions that's always made is that if two states is this hard, it's infinitely harder to achieve one state. But why are we assuming that two states is not harder? Two states is as hard, if not harder, to achieve because of the unwillingness for Palestinians to police their own border, to manage their own economy, to be sovereign over their own trade. They'd never have a standing military.
Is it unwillingness or inability?
There is an unwillingness. Okay. These are on the terms that Palestinians...
On the Israeli side, and the American side,
that Palestinians, under any of the solutions we've seen, would never exercise meaningful sovereignty, which begs the question of whether or not it's more realistic. And I think we should challenge the assumption that it is realistic. And then finally, the idea, this is the other basic and flawed assumption, is that occupation conjures this concept of partition. There is no partition. There is no two states to speak of. The Israeli and Palestinian populations live in inextricable population centers. What divides them is the settler colonial condition that privileges a Jewish population vis-a-vis a non-Jewish Palestinian
population.
Well,
exactly. Thank you so much for putting it
that way.
You're
very welcome.
Because that is exactly correct. In other words, we have the one-state solution. Do you like it? Because if you don't like it, the really revolutionary thing, the really revolutionary thing is two states. I mean, that's the big change. All right, there's no way to take this structure of separate and unequal, radical, discriminatory structure and occupation and non-citizenship and disenfranchisement within the greater Israeli state and turn it into an equitable democratic state for all of its
That's
people.
That's a really
I'll tell
dismal
you
outcome.
I have no faith in humanity and in history, historical examples
that have done precisely
where,
that.
Where?
This was the end of part one of our conversation because it ran a little bit long, but stay tuned at palestine-studies.org. We're going to be uploading part two very soon. Thank you for watching.
And we will have part two of that in a couple of weeks' time. And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, which is a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM WZBC. It's part of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcast every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine next week.